Well, good morning and welcome to Trinity. Happy New Year. My name is Mike, and I'm so glad that you're here this morning. We're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 2, so I'd like to invite you to open to Matthew chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible, we've got a stack of them in the back. Don't be shy. Feel free to hop up and grab one, and I'm going to tell some of you what I told some of the kids who were here earlier this morning. There's a stack of notebooks in the back. Those are for kids. So kids, if you don't have one, feel free to go and grab one and some pens. And this is the deal that I'm prepared to make this morning. If you take notes for the next, 30 minutes or whatever, and if you show me those notes after church today, next time I see you, I will give you a king-size candy bar, all right? Big candy bar, if you take notes, just a little bit of... I'm a parent, I'm not above bribery. Motivation. Matthew chapter 2 is our text this morning. You can find it on page 757 in those Bibles in the back. Yes, smart move, go get a journal. Let's pray together. Gracious God, thank you for this morning, for the chance to be here together. I pray that as my words line up with your words, that they would fall on ears and hearts ready to receive them and respond. And God, I pray that if I say anything that isn't from you, that those words would be quickly forgotten. And I pray all of these things through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. A couple of weeks ago, right here on a Sunday morning, Mary read us a quote from C.S. Lewis, who observed that all of our hobbies have behind them some unfulfilled longing or desire. That all of our hobbies behind them have some unfulfilled longing or desire. For those of us who love to paint, perhaps it's a longing for beauty or for peace. For those who like to bake, perhaps it's for satisfaction or for the certainty that comes with an easy-to-follow recipe. For those of us who like to run, perhaps it's a longing for freedom or self-sufficiency. I have been thinking about that quote ever since, and especially as we come into a new year. I had a mentor who used to say all the time that there's always a thing behind the thing, which seems to be what Lewis is suggesting as well. And so as I've thought about my goals and my aspirations for this new year, many of which have to do with my hobbies, I've started to wonder, what is the thing behind the thing? What is the secret longing that's behind my hobbies? I think this is such a good and such an interesting question, such an interesting way to think about what it is we really long for. So, what is it for you? What are your hobbies? And is there a thing behind the thing, a secret longing that those hobbies speak to? For me, I love to hike and to backpack and to ski. I love to spend long days in the mountains, to take my canoe into wild places that my minivan can't go. I love taking photos, but mostly only of landscapes when I'm on a hike or backpacking. I do love to exercise for sure, but mostly I do that so that I can go farther in the mountains. Are you sensing a theme here? My longing is for the wilderness, for the backcountry, for places few others have or ever will experience. So is it a longing for solitude in a noisy world? For beauty or peace in a world that struggles to recognize or value either in any real way? Maybe. But the more I've thought about it, the more I think my longing is for adventure. It's for the unknown. So what is it for you? I think it can be different in different seasons, right? If you've got a newborn, your longings in this season might be different than if you're an empty nester, for example. But what, as we enter 2024, might your hobbies say about your longings? Are you longing for peace or for beauty? Are you longing for certainty or for meaning to know and be known? Perhaps like me, you're longing for adventure, for something a little bit wild and a little bit dangerous. Here's the point I'm trying to make. Jumping off a cliff into a lake in the wilderness will certainly speak to my need for adventure in the wild. It speaks to that longing, just like crafting the perfect mug of pour-over coffee speaks perhaps to the longing for quiet or for a slower pace. But ultimately, our hobbies don't do everything for us that we ask them to, right? They can never really fulfill our longings. If you've spent any amount of time in a church, you know what I'm going to say next. That Jesus is the one we long for. The only one who can really meet the deepest desires of our hearts. And so you want peace? The answer is what? Jesus. You long for meaning? The answer is Jesus. You long for beauty? The answer is Jesus. You long to know and be known? The answer is Jesus. For me, and I know this to be true, the greatest adventure of all is found in Jesus. As I mentioned on Christmas Eve, quoting St. Augustine, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in Jesus. He's the one in whom all of our longings find their answer. I long for adventure, and I know that the very best adventure of all is to be found in Jesus. And that if I want adventure, I need to seek him first. I get that. I know that to be true. The question then is how, right? I've identified the longing. I know the answer to the longing, but how do I get from here to here? How do I seek Jesus for the adventure that I'm longing for? That's the question I hope we'll answer this morning. That's what we're going to talk about this morning. The story of the wise men speaks directly to that journey, that question. We've got, well, the Bible doesn't actually say it's three men. We assume it's three men because there's gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but we'll say the three wise men, they're looking for something, obviously. They're longing for something. Otherwise, they wouldn't have seen a star, identified it as meaningful, and then walked, I don't know, hundreds of miles in order to find the answer to it. They're looking for something and longing for something, and then they find what they're looking for in Jesus. And if we look closely as we walk through their story together, we'll see that there's a great deal that we can learn from their journey about how to get from a place of longing to an encounter with Jesus, in whom all of our longings are fulfilled. And so for us, it's a story about how we might go about seeking Jesus, the one that we need, the one that we long for, and how we might seek him together in this new year. So let's take a look at Matthew chapter 2 and see what we might find in the text together. Look with me here, verse 1, Matthew chapter 2. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men came from the east to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him." Let's pause there first, and let's see what it is the wise men do. First, kids, if you're taking notes, here's your first answer. They're looking for signs together. Do you see that? It says right there, verse 2, "For we saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him." Last week, we observed that one of the ways God reveals himself is in creation. This week, we see it. These men from the east, and it's implied that they're not Jewish themselves, they see a star, God revealing himself in creation. They're looking for him. They're paying attention to what's going on around them. And they're doing it together. Do you see that? In verse 2, they say, "We saw his star." If you brought your own Bible this morning, circle "we," because they're not looking for God in isolation. They're not looking for God by themselves. They're doing it together. As we'll see in a moment, nobody in Jerusalem noticed the star. None of them. They weren't paying attention. But the wise men were. They're looking. They're paying attention. Here's what I'd like to encourage you to try, maybe even today. Text a friend and ask them, "Where did you see God at work this week?" Or ask the question at the dinner table or on the drive home after church today, where did you see God today? If we really believe God's at work all around us, then there's an answer to that question. There ought to be an answer to the question. Oftentimes, we're just moving so quickly that we don't stop and look. And when we start asking this question, I think we'll start seeing God at work all around us. And we'll encourage each other in the asking and the sharing to pay attention together. So how might we go about seeking Jesus? By looking for him together, just as the wise men did. Second, they don't just look for him together, they follow him together. They don't just look for God, they follow him. They go where he leads them, even and perhaps especially when it leads them significantly outside of their comfort zones. And they do it together. They see the sign, that is the star, and they leave their homeland in search of Jesus, the one to whom the star points. We don't know where they're from, just that they're from the east. Presumably, it's some great distance away. And they travel to a place where they're foreigners and outsiders. They go on a journey seeking Jesus, and they do it together. In the fall of 2011, I was fresh out of seminary and in my first year of college ministry. We weren't a particularly large college ministry, a dozen or so student leaders and maybe 35 students in total. And at the beginning of that year, five of those leaders came away with me to a conference where we were encouraged to think about how we might reach the students on our campus who didn't yet know Jesus. And I remember it like it was yesterday. We were sitting outside of the sort of main conference space in Southern California, so of course we're outside in a little circle, me and five students. And we were praying together, asking God to move on our campus. And I'll never forget when those five leaders said, I think maybe God is asking for us to pray that 50 students would come to know Jesus this year. Now, as the leader, I knew how crazy this was, how improbable. After all, the previous year, four students had made decisions to follow Jesus, and that was a really good year. It was a really good year. How are 30 students and 12 leaders going to possibly reach that many people? But those five students had been listening and they'd been praying and they were ready to step out in faith, to be uncomfortable. And so we committed to praying together every day that there was class for 50 of their classmates to decide to follow Jesus. And those five students started inviting. They started inviting to our large group gatherings and our small groups and to our social events. They began to risk asking students if they'd ever considered following Jesus. Frankly, it was terrifying. The fear of rejection is really real. And nobody wants to feel dumb. But you know what? Those students stepped out in faith and they did it together. They prayed every single day they had class. They took risks. They invited. They shared. They prayed some more. They invited. They took risks. They prayed. They shared some more. And by the end of the year, 51 students had made decisions to follow Jesus. 50. And then one more. God just saying, like, hey, I can do this. What extra for good measure? 51 students made decisions to follow Jesus either for the very first time or for the first time in a long time. Those students didn't just listen or look for the sign. They followed where God was leading them, even though it was deeply uncomfortable. Look, we are a brand new church. We haven't even been meeting together for 3 months yet. I think next week is 3 months. And there's an invitation, perhaps, in this text, not just to look for God at work among us, but also to go where he calls us, to follow him, even and perhaps especially into places that feel risky and uncertain, unsafe. I think it's one of the big challenges and the opportunities for us as a new church in this new year, as we settle into life as a church together, to continue to follow Jesus where he is leading, especially when it's into risky, uncharted territory, and to do it together. That's second. They don't just look, they follow. Third, the wise men ask questions together. Do you see that? Verse 1 and 2, the wise men came to Jerusalem. When they get to Jerusalem, it seems they're stuck. They don't know where to go next. And so they say, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews?" They're not exactly sure where the star is leading them. They follow the star to Jerusalem, and then they're stuck, uncertain of the way forward. Maybe you've felt like this before in your own life. Your parenting, your work life. Maybe you felt like this financially. You're stuck. You're just not sure what the right next step is. What do the wise men do? Well, they ask questions. They get curious. And how do they do it? They do it together. The wise men came to Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who's been born King of the Jews?" Friends, there is so much about walking in the way of Jesus, so much about following him that I don't know yet or understand. And I have some ideas about where he may be leading us, but there is still so much that I'm learning. And one of the things that I'm learning is how important it is to ask questions together, to be curious together, to wonder together, to say out loud the things that you're not sure about around others. So how do the wise men seek Jesus? By admitting when they're stuck. They get to Jerusalem, they don't know the next step, and so they ask the question. They say out loud the thing they're uncertain about. Now, they don't do it in a way that's critical or cynical. Maybe you have a friend like that, the one who's always got a question, when really they're just a pessimist. It's not like that. But in humility, when they're uncertain about the way forward, they ask. Now we come here in verse 3 to a brief aside about Herod. So look at this with me. Verses 3 and following. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, and assembling the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told Herod, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." And then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star appeared, and he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. When you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him." I want to pause here for just a moment, and then we'll get back to the wise men, just to make some observations about Herod. Because he's a pretty sharp contrast to the wise men. Unlike the wise men, Herod has totally missed the signs, completely. And he has more information than they do. He's got access to the scriptures, to the teachers of the law. The ones he asks the question, they know the answer. But they're totally oblivious. He doesn't go like the wise men do. Instead, Herod sends somebody else. "Can you guys go check this out for me?" He can't be bothered. In fact, the only thing that King Herod has in common with the wise men is that he asks questions about Jesus. The difference, we know the wise men asked questions about Jesus because they intended to worship him. They said so explicitly, right up there in verse 2. Herod, he asks the questions because he's intimidated by Jesus. He's fearful about what it means for his power. He's threatened. He says he wants to also go to worship him, but we know that isn't true. How do we know it isn't true? Because just a few verses later in Matthew, he'll kill all the baby boys in the area who are around the same age as Jesus in an attempt to eliminate what he views to be a threat to his power. The wise men, on the other hand, continue on their journey. Look with me, verse 9, after listening to the king, the wise men went on their way, And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. For those of you who are taking notes, the fourth thing that the wise men do is that they rejoice together and they worship together. Now, if you're here this morning in church, it's probably because, on some level, you already acknowledge how important it is to your spiritual life to worship with others. So let's not stop doing that. That's good. And I'd encourage you to find a few other times and places during the week to worship with others, whether it's in a small group or via text or by getting together with someone for a midweek walk. It's the first thing the wise men do when they see Jesus. The first thing they do, they fall down and they worship him together. But do you notice what they do beforehand while they're still on their journey? Verse 10, they saw the star. They rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Rejoice exceedingly with great joy. Considering how Matthew uses the words here, what do you think he wants us to know? Because he's a little bit redundant in the language. That they rejoiced exceedingly. Not with a little joy, but with great joy. God's sign for them leads to celebration. What's the first thing you want to do when you get good news? You want to share it with others, don't you? We love sharing good news so we can celebrate with our friends and with our loved ones. And the celebrating the wise men do here, it isn't just any celebrating. They rejoice exceedingly with great joy because God's leading them somewhere. God's sign for them leads to excessive rejoicing. They're not just celebrating because the commanders won, but because God is doing something. This is probably a terrible example because when the commanders win, it takes an act of God. But you get the point. The sort of rejoicing we see here is rooted in an acknowledgement that God has done something and is doing something. They're celebrating his work in a moment among them. And so they rejoice together. Likewise, we too ought to be a people who rejoice together, who together celebrate together God's faithfulness. And then continuing in verse 10, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and the dad jokes of dad jokes. But wait, there's myrrh. So good. The fifth thing the wise men do, you're welcome. The fifth thing the wise men do is they give. And how do they give? They give together. The wise men give together. This is what the wise men are known for today, isn't it? This is what we remember them for. Their generosity, the gold and frankincense and myrrh. They travel many miles to foreign land to give a child precious gifts. Of course, it shouldn't be considered that miraculous an action because in Jesus, God has given us himself. And so it's only natural and good for us to give ourselves in return. Sacrificial generosity shouldn't be shocking, especially for a Christian. But in a world driven both by consumerism and a fear of not having enough, and in a part of the country that has a very high cost of living, this kind of generosity that draws us close to God can feel really risky and uncomfortable. Oh, but what a joy it is to give. For the wise men, giving it as an act of worship. You can see that right here in verse 11. They fall down, worship, and then they open their treasures, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And when we give together, it helps us to correctly direct our worship towards God. Jesus himself said that one cannot worship both God and money. And so when we're open-handed with what God has entrusted to us, when we steward our money like this rather than like this, it orients our hearts and our worship towards God rather than ourselves, and towards God rather than towards money. There's a reason Jesus talks about money as often as he does, because he knows how easy it is for us to worship money rather than God. I'm sure you've experienced this. I know I have. Both the fear that there might not be enough and the joy that comes with open-handedness. I know many of you experienced that because we, as a church, already are marked by generosity. But it's something that I know I need to be continually reminded of. That it is so, so, so good for my own spiritual life and health to give and to do it with others. And lastly, for those of you taking notes, point six. If I told you up front there were 6 points, would have tuned out after two. They listen and obey together. Look at verse 12 with me. Being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. One of the phrases that comes out of my mouth over and over again in our home is this phrase, listen and obey. I say it all the time. Parents are nodding your head, right? Because really, it's really easy not to listen. It's really easy not to listen. We do that all the time. But honestly, what good is it to listen and not obey? We know this to be true, and yet we do it all the time. We know what God wants. Perhaps we've read it right here, only to promptly ignore what it says. The wise men, they're warned in a dream not to return to Herod, and they listen. They don't stop there. They depart for their own country by another way. Now, in doing so, they run the risk of angering a king, right? Herod. Herod asked them to go to Bethlehem and then return to him. And Herod's a vicious guy. It's a real threat. But they don't just listen, they obey. Here's what I think I want to say about this, and then we'll wrap up. In order to listen and obey well and faithfully, it is so, so important that we be in community, in each other's lives. First, because people in general tend to not really be that good at listening. I miss things people say to me all the time. All the time. But if someone else is there to say, hey, did you hear that? Or, I'm not sure that's exactly what they meant by that. What a difference it makes. For those of you who are kids who have siblings, right? You hear your parent tell a sibling an instruction. Your sibling ignores it. And you say, Mom asked you to do this, right? It minimizes the ability to make an excuse, doesn't it? What a difference it makes to listen with others. But second, listening and obeying in community provides a layer of accountability to follow through, to obey. We know this instinctively, I certainly do. There have been countless times, this is the new year, and so I'm thinking about this again. There have been countless times in the last 15 or 20 years, really, since I stopped playing soccer competitively, that I've told myself I wanted to get back into running shape, okay? I've done it 3 times now in my life. I'm currently on the 4th. And each of those times that I actually succeeded in getting back into running shape, there was a single thing in common. Anyone want to guess? I was doing it with somebody else. Otherwise, I might wake up early in the morning, like, I don't know, 6 times and go run, suffer through it when it's dark and cold. But eventually, I'd rather sleep or do whatever else. But if there's somebody else I'm running with, that's when I'm most likely to do it. So, how is God inviting you into greater obedience this year? I'd like to challenge you to think about that question today. Before the day is over, to tell somebody else. And I'd like to encourage us to be the sort of people who listen together to the voice of God, to what Scripture is saying, and to encourage one another to to take steps of faithful obedience in response to that word together. Not to earn something or to check off some box, but so that we might grow in intimacy with Jesus together. I desperately want adventure. I do. I long for it. I yearn for it. When I'm stuck without it, I start planning the next adventure. Maybe you do too. Or maybe you long for peace or rest or beauty or stability, and none of those things are bad in and of themselves. Many of those things we pursue that provide that sort of fulfillment are good gifts of God. A long hike in the mountains is 100% a gift from God. But I know that ultimately my longing for adventure can only ever be fulfilled by Jesus. And so for me this year, I plan to take a page out of Matthew chapter 2, to look for God, to pay attention, to follow where he leads, to ask questions when I'm stuck, to rejoice and worship with others, to give generously, to listen and obey. And I plan to do it all with others. Specifically for me, I plan to do it with you. And I hope you'll do the same. Now here's where I'd like to close. I promise we're almost done. I'd like to close not with us and what we ought to do, but with God. I'll make just two quick observations. First, if you look at Matthew chapter 2, you'll notice that God initiates every step of the way. That God put the star in place for the wise men to see. God spoke the words regarding the Messiah that the elders quoted. God sent his son into the world that we might be saved. The gold, frankincense, and myrrh, it belongs to God. The dream that told the wise men to return another way, that was him. God always takes the first step. He's always initiating, and this is such good news for us. The wise men aren't muscling all of this on their own effort. They're just responding to God's gracious action. And so let me be clear. I'm not telling you just to try harder to look for God this year, to be more obedient. I'm not just telling you be more generous. Rather, I'm inviting you to respond in faith to what God has already done for you in Jesus. And lastly, Jesus is the point of all of this. He's the center of it all. Not you or me or us. He's the one worthy of worship, whose self-giving love on the cross we give in response to, whose gentle and gracious voice we listen for, whose yoke is easy and burden is light. He's worthy of our worship, and meeting him is the greatest of all joys. And so we follow and we ask and we give and we rejoice and we worship and we obey, because he's worth it. He's worth all of it. Will you stand?